This is Dan Alford, and you're listening to Dan's Cadre of Experts. We've got an interesting fellow on today, Mark Budsby. We've got him on. I've trained with Mark. I own his knives, and he has an interesting history, and I think you're going to enjoy this. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you, Dan.
So how do we meet? It's a little place in Nacogdoches.
A little place in Nacogdoches, Combat Shooting and Tactics, owned by former Special Operations Operator Paul Howe.
What do you do in another life?
I've been a nurse for 35 years.
Right.
Critical care, supervised for about 20, so a lot of people management. You know, I try to apply a lot of those lessons in life from a leadership standpoint. I think that many of the problems we deal with on a regular basis, probably 78% have to do with communication, and lately the other 20 or 30% are probably accountability. So always, one of the things that drew me to CSAT was, you know, Paul wrote a book, Leadership and Training for the Fight. That leadership's always been emphasized, so I think that was part of the allure.
Let's back up a little bit on CSAT. Paul's been doing this for 15?
Started the company in 99. That's when we established, because we did a sweatshirt last summer and had him write that. So we've got it on there just for posterity, I guess. But so getting close to 25 years.
All right. And then his goal was to teach law enforcement, military, and civilians.
Hostage rescue being the most difficult thing and the most important thing, pretty much based his system around hostage rescue.
This is all live fire firearms training.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. They're actually finishing up a 20-plus person law enforcement advanced hostage rescue class right now at CSAT. Be finishing up tomorrow.
What are you doing down here?
Law enforcement class. I ran the shop yesterday afternoon. Sometimes I punch in and shoot them. It's a good chance to get some team tactics in, but with a full class, they really didn't need me, so it was easier to stay out of the way.
The shop. Tell us about the shop. Then we'll go back and get them details.
Bought the shop 2.5 years ago. It's Combat Shooting and Tactics. We have a website. It's csattss.com.
That's the pro shop.
It's the pro shop. We shirts, caps, merchandise. We try to have most firearms accessories.
Firearms
FFL.
Themselves.
We will be adding some firearms. Have sold firearms the last year or two to the teachers. And what I've tried to do is get some of the firearms in play, and actually let them touch them before they bring them to class. We had a rash of Guardian students over the last 3 or 4 or 5 years coming with Glock 43s.
What's a Guardian?
School Guardian in Texas. There's a Guardian program and the Marshall program. And the Guardian program was the route that most of the schools in our area chose to do. I believe we've trained over a dozen districts now. The recent legislation may have changed that a little bit, so we'll see how that evolves and develops.
Let's not forget that conversation.
Exactly. But putting guns in the hands of good, hopefully, mother hen type people in schools, both male and female. Obviously, it doesn't have to be hens. It can be. We don't want the roosters.
So these are teachers and administrators both?
Teachers and administrators both.
So
correct.
How many of you trained in at CSAT, do you think? You get a feel for that?
I believe I saw Paul posted in an email recently, we trained 13 districts, and some of them as many as 12 to one particular district has 30 to 40. So it's several hundred now.
So there's at least 150 armed teachers.
Yes.
And these are high schools?
All levels, elementary, junior high, and high school. So a lot of the campuses in our area are smaller campuses, maybe not 100% self-contained now, but for the most part, our mindset is you need to have somebody that can intervene in a minute or two, and that's hard to do on a big campus spread out.
Right. And so I've always said that anytime you have a gun-free zone, that's a criminal empowerment zone. So people are aware that the campuses that you're training teachers for do have armed teachers?
They've chosen to do it a couple of different ways. Some of the schools actually have signs out front saying, we have armed teachers.
I approve. Isn't that the way to go?
Absolutely. I think that's it's much like that security sign in your yard. You need to give people pause.
Mm-hmm.
You know, criminals as a whole, bad guys, whatever you want to call it, they search for soft targets.
And they avoid hard targets.
And they avoid hard targets. And
so have any of these schools had any problems once they put these signs up?
Not that we're aware of.
Excellent.
I think one of the ways I try to explain it to people that are uncertain, insecure, is that are we creating a bunch of meat eating killers? No, we're not. But I know for a fact that if I've got 6, 8, 10 more people that have their eyes on what's going on and coming in and out of their facility, that's huge. Because I truly believe that a lot of the wins that we have are never going to be known. They're gonna see that sign. They're gonna see someone that's vigilant. They're gonna see someone watching them as they drive through that parking lot, and they're gonna go on. To me, that's a huge win.
Yeah, that's all you can do.
Absolutely.
Okay, who's eligible for taking this class?
We do it for schools. We do it for churches.
Okay.
So, and that is one of the things we've pushed a little more lately. And I'll use my own church, for example. We're actually looking at training, and there's some budget money this year for training. And I'm going to push them to the Guardian class, hopefully. It's been an ongoing project. I've got several guys on board now. So we've started that conversation. We realize that just saying you have a security team is not enough. There's no plan.
Certainly not.
There's no plan. There's no continuity. So we have one particular gentleman who's been several years. He's from out of state, brings folks from his church. He's a medical malpractice defense attorney. So he services hospitals, and he's the advocate
another
for
them.
Another
soft target.
Another soft target. And he brings his church folks, and I was explaining to him about a year ago the difficulty I was having at my own church about getting people on board and getting them to take it seriously. And he said, I wish I was closer. I said, well, why? He said, well, I'd come talk to him. I said, and? He said, well, standard of care. He said, that's what I do for a living. And he said, do we not, when we invite someone into our house of worship, imply that we're giving them a safe place to do so? And I thought, that's brilliant. We need to look at that much more close. Which is one of the reasons too, and we discussed it beforehand, I think that hospitals are an extremely soft target that have never been given the serious security attention that they need. Working in a hospital for 27 years, especially as a supervisor, I was very vigilant and tried to pay attention to what was going on in my facility and ask questions if something seemed inappropriate. But I think it's taken way too lightly, and I think as much as we've looked at schools and now churches, that I would like to see hospitals included in that. It's kind of a personal thing to me.
But schools are specifically is an area that are specifically, you're exempt from the ability to carry a concealed weapon, correct?
The board is able to do that at their campus, correct?
Right. And but churches and hospitals, not
churches. Actually, there are some laws in effect that exempt them,
okay,
or to carry. Mm-hmm. Hospitals are one of the no-carry zones, so okay, it's an issue. It's an issue because a few good people in the right place could change a lot.
Right.
And that's something I hope that we can have more conversations about over the next couple of years. It shouldn't take a mass shooting or two at a hospital to get something done, and I'm afraid that's what's going to happen. We've had a stabbing in a facility. We've had a couple people shot in a facility, but you know, the conversation didn't get stirred up. It wasn't in the news cycle long enough. But that's another place that, I mean, I'm sorry, patients many times they're more vulnerable than they've been in their entire life.
Oh, yeah.
They don't need to worry about that, nor does the staff who's trying to take care of them. And
when seconds count, help is minutes away. What's the old saying?
Exactly.
Unless you have people on staff in place.
Exactly.
Would you like to describe this program, this Guardian class?
So what we found is the best formula is many times they're new shooters, and that's okay because that blank canvas is sometimes much better.
Mm-hmm.
The best formula we've found is a two-day, what we call a TAC pistol class, but it's really an introduction to marksmanship, safe weapon handling, how to shoot, how to stand, how to grip the pistol, how to actually press the trigger. These are the things that we try to give them, and we encourage them to do that 2, 3, 4 weeks in advance of a guardian class. And if they will go home and dry fire and put in that time and come back to the guardian class ready to shoot, we have a set of standards. It's 7 different drills that they're required to do to pass the guardian class. Very achievable goal with some work, some proper work.
And so dry fire, back up. Dry fire is when you unload the gun and you practice without ammo, so there's no cost.
Correct. Completely safe. Need to make sure you have a bullet safe room in your house to do so. Make sure your weapon's unloaded. We always check twice or multiple times actually before dry firing. And yes, just spending time getting to know that pistol, getting to know the trigger, getting to know the workings of it, and just getting comfortable with it for sure.
Well, we've had Paul on the show before, and I think Paul, back in the day when he was doing this for a living, was dry firing more often than he was running live ammo.
Correct. One of the quotes, I've heard it many times, can't quote it verbatim, but sometimes up to 2 weeks of dry fire, mm-hmm. a couple hours a day before they ever fired a live round.
The only reason I'm dwelling on it is just to make the point that people can practice without a range.
Absolutely.
And if it's good enough for Paul Howe, it's good enough for us.
Absolutely. And then your range time can be incremental, and just make sure you understand it's a little different when the gun goes bang, when that explosion occurs, and how you react to that. But that's the one thing you can't do dry firing, is that anticipation of recoil.
So take that 2-day tac pistol class, and that's open to anybody, right?
Correct.
Anyone, any?
Correct. We generally prefer that they have a concealed carry permit, so there's some sort of background check done, but we just look for good, solid citizens is what we're looking for.
Latest data I saw was people with a concealed weapons permit are 1/7 as likely to commit crimes.
I would say that's pretty accurate.
Yeah, no, it is accurate. Yeah. And so that just, you know, talk about a good background test. Yeah, that's
exactly.
Exactly. All right, so you take that, then you go into the Guardian class.
So the Guardian class, I try to explain it more as we teach you some tactics. We try to teach you how to handle a situation, worst case scenario, that you have an active shooter. And that is single person CQB, open door, closed door, inward and outward opening.
So we're not shooting on a square range here. We're going into a building.
It's not all flat range. There's a flat range portion. We do, we call it the Mary Catherine drill, the Sewell drill. Teach people how to keep their muzzle down, out of the way, and move around people, which in a school is definitely something you must consider, any public place for that matter. Mm-hmm. And then barricades, hallways. So if you understand how to take a hallway, how to take a T-intersection, and how to take a door, it's pretty much any building you're going to encounter that I'm aware of. It's just, you know, the only thing that changes is size and length of hallways and things like that. So,
and so the final exam, describe that, or am I jumping too far ahead?
No, you're not. We really, the 3-day class is built around the final day, mm-hmm. and that is shooting the pistol standards. It's one shot from the high ready in less than 2 seconds or less, one shot from the holster in 3 seconds or less, 2 shots from the high ready in 3 seconds or less. And then we have a 5-in-1, we call it a failure drill, because occasionally you will encounter people with body armor and different things. So it's 5 to the body, 1 to the head, and that's 6 seconds. And that's generally the multiple shot drills are the ones that give people the most trouble.
But you have a relatively small target area that you guys
correct
call
about a 6x13-inch spine box,
right? And so that's a little tougher than a CHL test.
Correct.
Quite a bit, actually.
Done from 7 yards. It holds you accountable, but you know, when you take a pistol into a school, you should be accountable.
Absolutely.
So that accountability needs to be there, and you need to understand, we actually have a Guardian 2 class, which teaches you how to move around people and teaches you about masking targets, and that, you know, also, you know, you got to be aware of your foreground and your background as well, not only what's beside the target, and those come into play as well.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. You guys, I've seen how you try to trick the students. You'll put a bad guy target in front of several good guy targets.
Correct.
And bullets go through people.
Or behind, and I've done that. We do that frequently, and they make a great shot, and they're proud of themselves, and then there's a hole in the gentleman behind, or the target behind, that was a non-shoot target. And the reality is that's life. That's what we have to start looking at. Sometimes you have to change that angle. You can't always, just because it's the right thing to do to shoot the bad man, you can't always do it situationally, because it's not okay to shoot other people. I don't know. I don't want to go down and stir anything up, but a friend of mine sent me a video just recently, the last couple of days, where officers shot fired 82 rounds at a subject in a street in a neighborhood. That's not okay. I mean, there's no situation where that's okay. And that's one thing that, you know, Paul and CSAT has always stressed is we don't break a shot that we're not looking at our sight and our target. You know, our front sight is their focus. So we don't teach a double tap. We teach a controlled parry that you have sighted fire each time you pull the trigger.
And this final test where you're moving through the building, dealing with all these crowds where you have good people, bad people, this is pass-fail, right?
Pass-fail, that's correct. All we ask is it's no time limit on that portion of it.
Mm-hmm.
All we ask is you make two good upper thoracic hits because that's where the stuff is that's hard to fix because you want to put that. You can't go in and train that. We also have a TAC Med class, which is our Guardian 3 class as well. And that's all about how to treat people and making sure that you have a safe environment to treat in. And you can't safely treat anyone until the threat is neutralized. That's the key.
That's something I've always appreciated about CSAT is you guys always include a medical portion of it.
We try to do that, and that's one thing that I'm super passionate about. And I actually just got word today that one of the school districts we trained this summer, they're buying 124 stop the bleed kits, and that nothing makes me prouder than that. That I'm going to go train them, do train the trainer. They're going to turn it around, and they're going to make it a culture in their school, which is great for me because the reality of them using a tourniquet or a junctional packing kit is more realistic than them having to use a weapon.
Sure,
it's great information. And what I found is that the reason we train, the reason we come to classes, and you know this, it's many times it's just to inject, to get some safe stress and learn how you react to that and how you perform. You know, one of the keys with the Stop the Bleed class, we talked about it earlier, is it has to be immediate pressure, either with the tourniquet or with your pressure on a junctional wound. And when you get that immediate pressure on there, you're one-handed then. So all your stuff has to be accessible with one hand. It's just reality.
It's not one and done. You're there. You know, I wouldn't know when to quit applying pressure.
You don't, actually. If you have a tourniquet and you can get the tourniquet on effectively, you do. But for a junctional wound, what we teach is if you own it, you own it until you get to. I'm going to say if it's a loved one of mine, I'm going to not pass that off until it's someone that I know understands and knows what they're doing, unless I'm just so exhausted that I can't go on.
Yeah, because a bleeding femoral wound will kill you pretty quickly, right?
A 30, 40-second bleed out, if then that may not. We teach about a 40-second module, try to fix it in less than 30. It's what we teach. But the reality is, if that thing bleeds for 15, 20, 25 seconds before you get it stopped, that clock doesn't restart. It just starts again. And so that time is it's cumulative. It's not sequential. You know, it's there. You don't get to restart the clock.
I was in Chicago this last week, and somebody asked me what I had with me, and it was the med kit that you guys inspired me to. So I'm running the same stuff you guys recommend: tourniquet, gauze, Coflex, and I had a few of my own things to it. But you know, that's the basis right there.
Absolutely, and that's. For example, on our Stop the Bleed kits, we don't include hemostatic gauze.
And you do not?
We do not on the general kit. There's a couple reasons. One, we build that kit. We take the gauze that we use, it's two pieces of tack gauze that we use currently on a small ABD in just a rip-away Ziploc bag, a cheap Ziploc bag, because I want it to be accessible with one hand and able just to tear that thing open. We knot the end, and that's something we stole from Paul years ago, placing a knot on there or a power ball. Well, that's so you can find it in the dark, in the blood, in the mud. If I'm holding, I don't even have to look. If I feel that knot, I know that's the end of my gauze.
Yep.
I shove it in that wound. I'm holding pressure at the same time. I've got to be able to do that while maintaining situational awareness and keeping pressure, and it's a big deal. So the studies have shown that hemostatic gauze is great. But most of the time, and as Doc has said before, if we're going to use the hemostatic gauze, you need to go ahead and open that too, and you need to stage it in your kit. The problem with selling the hemostatic gauze to schools for me is that I want these med kits to be deployed everywhere, and when you put the hemostatic gauze, sometimes you include expiration dates, and I don't want to do that.
Plus,
that
it's 30 sense. Bucks instead
Plus
of
it's
3
more
bucks.
Expensive. So what we encourage the people that come to our TAC Med class is, absolutely, I will sell you hemostatic gauze, but that's your decision. I'm not gonna pre-sell you that and just to try to get money. The reality is, though, it's about it's shown to be about 30% more effective than just pressure alone. So it's worth looking at for sure. But I don't have it in all my kids. I have it in some of my kids. But understanding that there's no substitution for pressure.
All right, so you're out there teaching guardians, teaching civilians, teaching med, and then you've got the pro shop. Did we miss anything on that?
No, well, other than the pro shop belonged to our LE lead instructor, and I bought it from him about 2.5 years ago because I guess I think I took my first CSAT class in March of 17, took the instructor class in March of 18. And after getting, I regretted not going sooner. And after getting a taste, it's, I want more of this. So I got a lot more of it over the last 6 years or so. But was at a local knife show, maybe 2019, or gun show actually. Ran into a gentleman. He was there set up. He's doing a little farms, lasering and things like that. And we strike up a conversation, come to find out he's a knife maker. I've always been fascinated with knives. It's always been something that I was fond of, and went over and started buying a few things from him. And I said, hey, I want to learn. He said, well, just don't compete against me. I said, no, I don't want to buy equipment. I just want to learn. He said, all right, I'll teach you. So
this is Jamie.
This is Jamie, James Kugler. If you're familiar with karambits, and Jamie was probably 20 years ago was one of the number one or two, three karambit makers in the world. So
I didn't know
pretty
that.
Big footprint then. Yeah. Started CNC Bladeworks actually back then, and then it morphed into Kugler Custom Knives, and that's when I met him, and he'd moved to Lufkin. I'm like, dude, how did you end up in Lufkin? He said, well, I'm a woman. I said, okay, that makes sense. That's most it happens. Great lady that he's married to. Went over, was spending a lot of time, built, I guess, 95% of my own knife, wrapped it for the heat treat, and, you know, did the profiling, did the hollow grind, everything but sharpen it, oddly enough. And, you know, I take a lot of pride in being able to sharpen a knife. But sharpening on that sander is an entirely different ballgame. And that 20-plus years of experience, he beats me at that quite a bit. So I can't take that away from him. But so I say 95% because I let him sharpen it at the end. But built the sheath. And I was showing Paul some of this stuff. And I knew Paul liked knives, but I didn't realize Paul's as much of a knife fan as I am, if not more. So I was showing him some stuff, and he said, hey, you want to do a CSAT knife? I'm like, yeah, I do. So I go to Jamie, and we talk, and that's literally how BC Bladeworks was born.
And what's BC Bladeworks?
It's Busby Kugler. That was Jamie's idea, having been CNC Bladeworks before. I told him, I said, really, you should be first. He said, it doesn't flow as well, so I'm not going to argue with you, so whatever. So I went over for the first year and a half before buying the shop. And I did about 50% of the work, actually. So I can call myself a knife maker, honestly. Did a lot of the profile. We cut stuff out at the time on a bandsaw, profiled it on the sander. I was building sheaths, building handles, actually doing the handles on the knives.
So what are those sheaths? Do you use in Kydex?
We use Kydex. Right. Yeah, we have just a press that we okay. Each one is molded, each individual knife. We have a lot of guys that say, hey, I'd like another sheath. I'm like, you may have to send me your knife because that handle's going to be subtly different. And,
right.
You know, I don't want a fit that rattles or anything like that. So that's ideally what we're trying to do.
And the handles, what are you using for that?
G10 primarily. Yeah. Occasionally carbon fiber, but G10 has proven to be a great, nearly indestructible material. Even when we do our kitchen knives, I tell people you really should hand wash them, but you can run them through the garbage disposal. You might see, you can run them through the dishwasher. It's not going to be a problem, but you don't want, a lot of times you get, you know, stainless, as you know, you're quite familiar with metallurgy. Stainless doesn't mean necessarily rust-free.
So. Not at all. What is your metal? You're using multiple metals.
Mostly AEBL, however. And that was one of the knife-making companies out there who sold material reached out several years ago, as I understand it and reading about it, said, guys, y'all ought to try this. This is steel they made razor blades out of for years. I have found, for me personally, I had kind of gone down the route of buying some of the crucible steel or the powdered steel on the blades that I had done, or the knives that I had bought before meeting Jamie and some factory stuff, and I really like that toothiness of the edge. Mm-hmm. What I've seen with the AEBL is once you sharpen it on that machine, it is super sharp, even with a toothy edge. What I really like about it is, as you know, I use a, I think you might too now, a Wicked Edge sharpener.
You made me buy one.
And that, Wicked Edge, is it just sets the angles. It makes sharpening so much easier. But you can put a very polished edge on it with that Wicked Edge sharpener, and it's still aggressive and it still cuts. And to me, that kind of sells me on that steel. I've not looked much harder for anything else, because the fact that a guy can sharpen it with a diamond stone or he can sharpen it with a strop, it's still going to have a good cutting edge, and that to me is huge.
But you're doing Damascus, you're doing all this other stuff.
A little Damascus stuff, yeah. We've got some. Jamie has done potentially more work with Damascus than many people.
That's titanium.
It's titanium. It's two. What they do, instead of having really two types of titanium, it's two grades.
Okay.
And so you'll get a little differentiation in color, so you can see patterns and things like that in it. So he's made wedding rings out of it. I have a top that he made out of titanium. Some coubetons and stuff like that.
But you're making blades?
That'll be usually the handle material.
Oh, for the handle. Oh, okay. Yeah. Because it won't hold an edge.
Yeah, I've got a couple that have complete Damascus sides and clips on them. Mm-hmm. Really pretty. Get a lot of blues and purples and things like that in it. So it's a neat and something that he's really good at and understands after doing it for so long. So that helps too.
And in complete disclosure, you and I worked on a knife. It's something I've been wanting a long time. So I wanted a fixed blade, I wanted a clip, and I wanted a Kydex holster. I wanted a flat back. I wanted a false edge on the back. And next thing I know, it existed.
I'm super proud of that. We had talked about this probably three times before actually doing it, at least. And where I was trying to go with it is, everybody that was doing a pocket fixed blade was using a Discreet Carry Concepts clip, which is great company. I use them on a lot of my holsters for inside the waistband.
But the clip's on the sheath.
But the clip's on the sheath. And so you had an extra long sheath, different things, and that's what you kept saying, can you put the clip on the knife? I'm like, yeah, but I'm not sure how. And so, just full disclosure, finally Dan laid down a knife and some money and said, build it. And so
that's how you motivate.
So we did one version that we weren't crazy about. We basically took a knife that we were already making and
did a single
took
side
a scale off. Yeah, put a clip on it, and I let Dan carry it for a couple of days when he was there training, and he's like, yeah, but that's not quite it.
But you sold it, right?
And another student bought it that day, so that was kind of cool too.
New version has two scales on both sides.
Exactly. Went back to Jamie and said, hey, this is not it. And so we did, as Dan said, just a straight back single edge, because we do a lot of double edge stuff from a tactical standpoint. Abbreviated the size a little bit. Yeah, false edge on the back, because it can be sharpened. And we did sharpen one for somebody that requested it. And putting the clip and making the sheath wider with the pocket hook was huge.
Worked great.
Just a game changer. Yeah. And I carried one for a couple months reverse in the left hand.
Oh, that's wrong.
Well, for me, it's right, because if I train saber grip in my right hand, and I train reverse grip in my left hand for a weapon retention standpoint.
Void's a warranty.
So, but anyway, it's been a great knife. And some of my better videos, you know, Instagram and Facebook, have been in response to that knife and how it deploys out of the pocket. I think it's because it is different than anything else, and it works. That's the key. One of the coolest things for me is, as far as I know, nobody's reported back that they've cut their pocket. The sheath design turned out great.
Yeah, it's worked out well.
It's been huge.
And I've seen some hatchets you guys make. What
else? Tomahawks.
It's a tomahawk.
Yeah, I'm pretty well. One is a camp hawk. I think that's kind of where we've morphed into. Has a hammerhead on the back. We use 1/4-inch steel for the hawk material. And so on the back, we use 2 more 1/4-inch pieces, which gives you a 3/4-inch striking service if you need to
welded,
hammer tent stakes
in. Do?
Bolted on. It's all hardened, so it takes a great edge. And then we've got a couple new designs coming out. One has no sharp edges, something that Coy, who's a 40-plus year martial artist, also a CSAT instructor.
Is that a training knife?
It's, well, this is more of a, somebody, we we have a class on Monday nights where we train close quarters tactics. And I walked in one night and he said, so I saw this guy today. He was talking about he'd never fight with a tomahawk because there's something that'll always get hung up on it.
Oh, so if it's flat.
So we basically made a round head that has no areas to hang up. It works quite well, actually. And you can choke up, and it's just essentially a blade from there. But it's also can be less lethal with the striking surface as well. So a couple things that we're kind of working on. We did finally, when I bought the shop and started more onto the selling and marketing side, I let Jamie morph back into more full-time knife maker. And so instead of me going over and running the bandsaw and profiling the stuff, I carried it to a local company and have it water jetted. And once we decide on the finished product. So it's still totally handmade. It's just that we get the blanks cut. He still does all the grinds freehand. And because occasionally people say, well, this side doesn't quite match that side. And I'm like, I know. I'm okay with that. You know, I don't.
That's the opposite of what I would have said. Because, you know, when I see multiples, they look identical. And I wonder how in the world you do it.
That's 20 plus years of standing at that grinder. Hmm. It's crazy.
So we'll do it again at the end. But what's the website or how are they going to find this?
So we sell them straight through CSATTSS.com. And there's
CSATTSS.com.
Got it. And I have a BC Bladeworks page, which I've been a little negligent about. There's some pictures on there. Actually, there's some pictures of you carrying on there. All that's still there. I just need to get a little more aggressive about updating it. But we try to keep the CSATTSS page fairly updated. Paul, CombatShootingAndTactics.com. His newsletter, he does a little knife highlight each month, and so
I can always tell when you got something new.
Exactly. I feed him pictures whenever we do something new, and that kind of gets out there too. And then I have I post about three times a week to Instagram from BC Blade Works, and just try to keep that. It's not much opinion. I've just started doing a little more verbalization on there, talking about the product a little bit, but it's still more just exposure.
You didn't say anything about folders. I've seen some folders.
Really like the folders. It's in the custom market, especially in our area, it's a little bit hard to tap, but the ones that we've sold and that people have put in use, they've been super pleased with. I think the quality is outstanding, and we're really, you know, if you're a custom knife person, we're probably still at 70-75% of what we should be charging for them.
I agree. You're reasonable.
And the quality's there. We have a couple of new ones that Paul actually kind of drove based off a knife that he's fond of, and I'm super proud of the way they turned out. Jamie passed them off to me yesterday, and they're really, really well done. The knife we did with Paul, the first collaboration that started BC Blade Works, is the scalpel. And that was, we did 25 signed and numbered with OD handles. Paul signed his code name on one side with an engraver, and Jamie and I signed the other side with an engraver. And then before the 25 was done, we started using a laser and actually doing a little official on them too, but we still signed the first 25.
Yeah.
And that was well received. So that's probably the model that's been the most popular overall. And then the little Hornet that I did about a year or so later, I was kind of skeptical because I didn't like the way it looked, but it's been one of the most popular things we've ever done, and it may be my favorite still, oddly enough. But I should also add that the knife that we did with the pocket clip, we named Dan because of it's bullet,
right? In
but the
Japanese,
kanji is Dan, correct?
Yeah, the kanji is Dan, but. Yes. It means bullets. So.
Yes, that's nice.
So that one's going to outsell them all, trust me.
Well, so far it's done really well, so that's good. That's good.
Okay, we were talking about that Guardian thing. That's been in the news lately, hasn't it? So this whole Guardian program was something that Texas legislature made possible, but it wasn't very formal at first, now was it? Aren't they changing what? That?
I don't know the timeline on it, but they gave schools the option to do the Marshall program or the Guardian program. And I'm not familiar enough with the Marshall program other than to say research it a little bit. But my understanding was it was more boot campish, and One of the things that they did was they required or asked that they keep their weapons in a safe, and I just didn't like any of that. So we just kind of, something that we never really looked at as far as being realistic.
Your guardians keep the weapons on them at all times.
We encourage no off-body carry, because then if you do that, you cannot ever leave your bag laying anywhere. You know, guardians have to realize too, they can't break up fights. They can't introduce a weapon into a emotional situation like that. So there's quite a bit of training that's involved. The guardian programs were chosen especially by a lot of rural school districts because they could give each teacher a stipend and give them the training, and they weren't putting out a ton of money. And again, like I say, you've got several more sets of eyes that are aware of that there's bad things that can happen, and they're looking out for it. And so it's been a really good formula. We have several school districts that have both SROs and guardians that work together and understand their roles, and I think that's huge, because, you know, the school district I live in is three separate campuses, and the high school and junior high on the same piece of dirt, but it's still quite strewn out. And I think they have, you know, four officers or so, but they still can't be everywhere at the same time. I mean, they can't cover every area. So, you know, having a few people seated throughout the district, I think, is very smart.
And so when this started, Paul came up with the program. It's all his design. There wasn't a lot of standardization, right?
And that's correct.
And that's what legislation is doing, isn't it? Standardizing?
It's what they're attempting to do.
And so how's it going?
In my opinion, they dropped the ball. I've reached out to my local state representative asking them to review it. They pushed it to TCOL and ALERT.
What's a TCOL?
In the bill. Texas Commission on Law Enforcement.
Okay.
And all I really, you know, I don't... Not to speak ill, there are some great individual officers out there, and there are some departments that are spun up, and they train and they take care of things. So we have a Central Texas department that they train a lot. They send people to us a lot. They're turned on. They're on the ball, and that's great to see. But we also have local departments that those guys qualify once a year, and you know they don't train at all, and so that's an issue. I guess, you know, all I can say is the LE guys out there that are practicing or training or thinking, thank you for your service. Those guys that have never bought a round of ammo unless it was given to them by their department, they probably need to step it up. And so, you know, to me, the report card was Uvalde. And
that didn't go well.
I did a little reading this morning. 19 died. It was over an hour before they punched in. So all those guys were trained to some degree, had to pass some set of qualifications that was TCOL.
Well, these weren't. You're not talking about
was
teachers.
The next thing. No, I'm not talking about teachers. These were all law
these
enforcement
are
guys. These are guys that are paid to go in and do the opposite of what they did. And so there's a lot of debate about leadership and that kind of thing there. Well, there shouldn't be any debate about leadership. As Paul has said thousands of times, hostage rescue is that time you push. And this was a hostage rescue situation. And then the other failure, obviously, was nobody got treated for over an hour.
Right.
And so that's huge, too. And one of the things with medical, again, that he's always said, if you don't bring it, it doesn't get there.
Yeah, Paul has us all bring tourniquets. Each student is...
I've tried not to be a hypocrite. I have, it's a TCCC approved pediatric RMT tourniquet. I've started selling them to the schools as well for their elementary campuses, but it'll fit my leg. It'll fit most adult legs. And I've carried one every day for a year and a half now.
Well,
just not to be a hypocrite. And I believe in it, because again, if I don't have it, it's not there. It doesn't do me any good, or it doesn't do you any good.
And you don't need a Band-Aid. You need the stuff for the major trauma.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And this can be a motor vehicle accident. It can be somebody sticks their hand in a plate glass window. It can be numerous things that, you know, you can bleed to death from. It doesn't have to be a gunshot wound.
Mm-hmm. All right. So your standard, do you have any feel for what CSET Guardian standards are versus TCOL or any of the others?
I do to some degree. I'll tell you a couple quick stories. It's a little bit disappointing. I'm not going to name any specific people or districts, but there are a couple school districts that sent teachers to us last summer for guardian training, and one of them also sent their SRO, or school resource officer. Mm-hmm. He was a 30 plus year law enforcement officer, and he could not pass our CSAT standards, the Guardian standards.
Yeah, you have two sets of standards. Let's be clear. When you took the instructor standard,
right.
That's tough.
Whole different ballgame.
I passed it a couple times.
Yes.
And I failed it a lot.
Yes, whole different ballgame. Yeah.
But the Guardian standards
are achievable.
Absolutely.
I will also say that I still remember the look on a couple of new shooters that were guardians in that school, that were, I think, both elementary teachers. The look on their face when they saw that they had a guy at their school carrying a gun that they could outshoot. And it was really just shock.
It's probably good for them.
Oh, it was great for them.
Yeah. A little disappointing for the school.
The school district did resolve that issue. But we have yet another one that sent a guy for training that his teachers passed and he didn't. And as far as I know, he's still working. So he's still a law enforcement officer, but he couldn't pass those guardian standards. So to me, carrying that gun in that school is super important. And one of the discussions I had with the guy from Central Texas is maybe we should start looking at our school resource officers as the best of the best and not, you know, your final resting place and make it to where you take the guys that are active on SWAT and are good patrol officers and you say, hey, you got kids in school. Would you like a schedule that fits theirs? Or, you know, this is part of your stepping stone to a higher level, and make it, again, active shooter. You know, you mentioned it then, where Paul drove the Guardian program is it was citizen response to active shooter. It's still a CRAS class, but we just add standards into it so that you have a measurable system. So simple as that. It's
So what happens if you don't pass? You still get a certificate, right?
Of attendance, correct.
Of attendance.
And we encourage to come back. We've had some take it a couple of times.
You've had have them fail a couple times, but you still have to pass before you are.
Yes. We had a couple of had one this spring and two last summer that were great people and people that I wanted to see be guardians without question. Right. And I told them, I said, we can do a private lesson. We can do this however you want to. I want to see you pass this class. And within a week or two, they came back and they passed. Not once, yeah. Two or three times. It mattered to them. Those are the kind of people we want anyway. And so when they failed and it makes them step up, that's a great thing, right? Because they really didn't fail. If you fail and you're okay with it, that's not okay. You're not the kind of person I want carrying a gun in your school, in a school.
You know, I took that very first CRAS class way back in the day. It was excellent. And I'm glad to see it morphed into this. And you're doing good things with the Guardian class.
Even with the churches, we try to encourage them that, you know, keep the records. And occasionally, you know, quarterly, do make people go through the standards. Because if you ever do need to solve a problem in your church, you need to be able to validate that you were trained. I mean, that's huge.
We try to shoot every week. In fact, that's one of the reasons we've got you down here from Nacogdoches. What are you doing this evening for us?
Do a little red dot class for you this afternoon.
What is a red dot?
I took my first class at CSAT about 6 years ago. I shot my first class at CSAT with a pistol dot about 5.5 years ago. And
the alternative to a dot is iron sights.
I got a little ribbon about it, right? So, but it's okay. I'm kind of the equipment guy, but the other side of that coin is I've been wearing corrective lenses since fourth grade. And what I found as I got into my late 40s and early 50s is that front sight, that distance 2, 3, 4 feet away, it was a little blurry.
And the point of the exercise is when you're shooting a pistol, you're not focused on the target.
The thing that is on the front sight.
Yeah, your focus is on the target. And if your arms aren't long enough,
I was having a lot of trouble. I hold myself to a pretty high standard, but I was having trouble meeting that standard from a visual standpoint.
And that's the beauty of a holographic red dot sight. It's more precise, but typically it's slower. Until what?
Until people understand how to present it. And that's one of the keys, and that's one of the things Paul and I talked about early on. I did probably the first red dot class 3 years ago, and the lesson was, it is something you have to put reps into and you have to practice. And like we mentioned the dry fire earlier, the presentation, you don't even have to practice once you understand. I mean, you don't have to dry fire necessarily. You practice the presentation. And once you understand that, it's about presenting the pistol the same way over and over again. As, of course, we've heard many times, you know, the key to consistency, or the key to marksmanship, is consistency. It's doing the correct things and repeating it over and over again. Mm-hmm. Well, the dot presentation is very much that. It's understanding your wrist angle, how your support hand works, and that dot will be there. Once you see it over and over again, after you see it a couple thousand times, you know it's there. You trust it. There's no issue. And I think ultimately you can be faster, because that to me is one of the huge benefits of the dot, is you can be target focused. I give you food for thought. If I told you real briefly to explain to me, someone that had never touched a pistol before, how you shoot iron sights, what would you tell them?
You put the front sight in between the two rear sights and put that precisely over the target you want to hit and pull the trigger.
Over it?
Yeah.
Yeah. But what if I told you to explain it with a dot?
Well, what most people have trouble with is finding the dot within the glass.
Right.
And then so that's what you're saying. You got to get that.
It's just a matter of pointing. Right. So I always think about, you know, if you get to talking about sights and rear sight and understanding, we've had people shoot a 2-day class and I really still don't know how they're looking at the sight on an iron sight, if that makes sense.
That's true. And with a red dot, you either see it or you don't.
You either see it or you don't. So yeah. I can tell you that this is a little bit of a rabbit hole, but if I give you a set of iron sights, you've never touched a pistol before, and I say, I need you to put that front sight right below where you want to hit. You put your target right on top of it. But it has to be centered between that rear sight, and it really needs to be level with that rear sight, and then don't disturb that while you pull the trigger. And that's probably about as brief as I can explain how to shoot iron sights. So but if I tell you with a dot, look at your target, look at the spot you want to hit and put the dot on it, to me that's more simple. And I will go a little further to say, having taken a brand new shooter and started them with a dot and seeing where they could go in about 2.5 days, it was crazy. Good student, don't get me wrong, took instruction well, but was able to understand it. All we had to really worry about was once they figured out how to make a good trigger press, it was huge.
And I'm seeing a lot of police departments going to red dot sights now, right?
They are. I think
everybody's getting older, and as you need reading glasses, you either going to have to wear glasses when you're shooting, but the red dot will allow you to have slightly worse eyeballs and still shoot accurately.
That, and I think one of the reasons we're seeing it more and more is it's a different time than you and I grew up in. Would you not agree?
Absolutely.
I probably shot a gun first when I was 5-6 years old. I don't know. I shot almost
sort of late bloomer, weren't you?
Yeah. Well, in a way, yes, you're right. I don't know that I ever had any really good instruction until, you know, middle teens. And we had a local deputy who kind of took me under his wing and taught me a little pistol stuff. And then I was fortunate. I met some guys that had a gun club at our local area. And so for a couple of years in college, I shot on the weekend quite a bit and got a basic understanding of, you know, marksmanship. And until I got to CSAT, I thought I could shoot. Well, and then I found out, well, there is another level, right? And then to me, it's another level when you start adding in the tactics. And you have to learn that not only, you know, marksmanship is just a small part of what we do. Mm-hmm. It's a part you can, if you're shown properly, you can go home and work on. But in order to do the tactics and really understand it, marksmanship is something you need to kind of start figuring out on your own. So
there's a couple of things about CSAT I'd like you to explain. And, you know, first one is the scrambler. And I tell you, I have never cleaned the scrambler. I never hit all my shots on the scrambler until I got a red dot. Because you guys are pushing pistols out to how far?
50, 60 yards, I think, is the furthest one.
That's pretty far. Yeah. And so that's on a 6-inch
six by 13.
16, yeah. So that was tough for me. Right. But I could do it with a red dot. And that's when I became a believer.
It's huge getting that dot gives you instant feedback. And I think you've probably seen people that were new to the dot look at it and go, God, it's moving a lot.
Yeah, you've always been moving a lot.
And so, exactly, you've always been moving a lot, but it gives you a much clearer idea of how much it's moving, and I think that's huge.
So if we go to CSET, though, there's a lot more than these square ranges. So the scrambler, you're moving and shooting rifles, pistols, and running in the
correct
process.
About a 500-yard running gun.
What's the record?
I don't know, but I might have been when you run it 3 or 4 times with different teams, you don't care anymore. You just want them to get done. No, it's actually a lot of fun. The students enjoy it. One of the biggest things it teaches you is how to shoot around and breathe,
right?
When you're exerted, right? And mm-hmm. So you know, we alluded to it earlier about training, but one of the reasons we train is to find out what we do under stress. Well, adding the stress, the cardio, mm-hmm. you get that heart rate up, you get that respiratory rate up. To me, that's a real clear picture of how well you understand marksmanship and how to press that trigger.
Yeah, you need to know how far away you can make an accurate shot.
Exactly.
So that's one of the things. And tell them about shoot houses.
So the shoot houses are really, to me, the bread and butter of CSAT, because you get immersed in it. And I mean, they're open top OSB rooms with center fed and corner fed doors, inward open, outward opening. But you can imagine them to be anything from a school to a trailer house. And, you know, you take people in there, and I've had really, really good shooters, shooting the center out of a bull target at 25 yards and taking them to the shoot house, and they shank one a foot left because all of a sudden they're doing another task while they're shooting.
Precisely. They're overwhelmed. And so you're having to deal with opening doors, bad guys, good guys in the same room together. To me, the shoot house is some of the most challenging work that you guys
absolutely
put us through.
And then imagine doing that in real life never having trained it.
Yeah, we're all running real ammo, but none of the paper targets shoot back.
Correct. So that's where I see the real benefit of the system. And, you know, with the legislation pushing TCOL and ALERT, they do the work with SIMs. And so
what's a SIM?
It's simunition round. So, I mean, 400 feet per second, it's kind of a plasticky paint bullet, and
you can take a shot.
Well, in real life, you may not can take a shot, you know. And so it may be slightly diluted, would be the best way to say it.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you look back at Uvalde, and all it would have taken was a couple of guys to go, hey, we're going to stop this right now.
Well,
early on,
how it all ended up happening.
Yep.
A couple of guys drove
and
in.
And it happened over an hour too late. And so that's kind of the mindset we try to push, is that you're the one that's going to make the difference. And if you're by yourself, go.
Yeah.
And that's the reality. If you're waiting, you're wrong when it comes to stopping an active shooter, if you're trained.
Well, they say you're supposed to train like you fight, but you also fight like you trained.
More.
And that was the problem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's it in a nutshell. Hmm. So that's why I would encourage people to look at House Bill 3, to look at them pushing it toward TCOL and ALERT, in that's who trained all the guys that were there. I don't know if that was the answer or not. I hope they fix their system. I would like it to be where, you know, people like Paul get a voice and they could bring him on for an advisory role, and maybe we fix the system, clean it up a little bit. I think that ultimately that would be where I'd like to see it go.
He was good enough in Mogadishu, you'd think he'd be good enough in a school.
I think it would be okay.
Suspect.
Yeah. You need a high standard. Like I say, carrying a gun into a school is a big deal.
Huge responsibility. Just carrying a gun on the street is a responsibility.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's been fun. What did we miss? What are we going to? We're just going to try to hit all the high points.
I think we got most of them.
Did we do good? All right.
I think we did.
So tonight you're going to try to cram a 2-day Red Dot class into an hour and a half. I appreciate that. I don't think it's going to work. But anybody that wants to go and get the full-blown 2-day Red Dot class or train it at CSAT with Paul, you and Paul, how do you start?
CombatShootingAndTactics.com.
Right.
All one word, A&D spelled out. There's a schedule on there. I've actually given the Red Dot schedule for next year. I'm doing an instructor class in November. We're going to do a 1-day. First Sunday in November will be a 1-day Red Dot Extreme Pistol class. I'll have there's already 10 instructor students signed up for the class, so we'll have a lot of hands-on in that 1-day class.
Now that's a tough class. How many people pass out in an instructor class?
My goal, Dan, is really on this one. It's not so much the tac pistol, still going to be a separate tac pistol, tac rifle, still a separate class.
Yeah.
So my goal, and I think you'll understand this, is that there's a lot of instructors out there, but there's not a lot of teachers out there. Mm. And so I want to really push looking at the student and analyzing and making sure there's a good stance, there's a good grip, there's a good trigger press. So I'm going to do it a couple. We may use the Guardian standards and may use the instructor standards.
Guardian standards are half the instruction.
Correct. And just
half speed.
The big test for that class will be them teaching and right. demonstrating on the final day, and that's where I'm really going to look the hardest at it, because I think you do the student a disservice. I went to a class. I try to get out and see the world a little bit, and you know, see alternative views. And I went to a one-day doc class up in Smith County, and the guy was former MIL, law enforcement. He essentially put a piece of tape on our dots, and we shot drills. He snopped off the internet all day. I heard him tell one person to relax their shoulders, and that was the only actual instruction done all day long. Not a bad guy, and I'm not running him down, but that is not. To me, that's not teaching anyone anything. I mean, if I bring you out and run you through a couple hundred rounds in a day, hopefully you're going to get better by the end of the day. But have you really learned anything? And so that's really going to be the focus of this class, is trying to get people where they can be more insightful, give them more ways to verbalize things. I learn something every time I teach. That's what I enjoy about it.
So at a minimum, though, folks will go up to CSAT, take the tac pistol class, get to know the people, see the rest of the facilities, and yes. then you can build upon that. Go into the CQB classes, Guardian.
Absolutely.
You guys will take us as far as we want to go.
As far as you want to go, and potentially even further. I mean, you've been there to do some stuff that was a little next level. You know, if you commit to it and you bring the basic skills, then, and again, you know, the basic skills is, as Paul's always said, high speeds of being able to perform the basics on demand. So, but that really is. And, you know, I hear that a lot among, you know, the guys I consider to be, you know, put together, squared away instructors, is it really is a matter of performing the basics. It's just doing the right thing.
And then you got to repeat them. I mean, you know, that's why I try to go back at least once a year. So,
right.
If you want a shooting school, I highly recommend it. What else you got, Mark?
I think that's it, Dan.
Well, let's head to the range. You got a dozen people to teach red dot to.
Sounds good.
I want to thank you for coming on today.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you very much.
Get you back again.